You're listening to A Slice of Therapy with me, Alan Parry. One of my favourite questions, and you've probably heard me mention this before if you listen to the podcast quite a bit, but one of my favourite questions is, what would this look like if it was easy? What would this look like if this was easy? And it's a question that has had a really profound impact on my life. And it's something that I pause and ask myself that question whenever I notice I'm getting stuck in a bit of a logjam. Now, the question is something I first heard from the writer Tim Ferriss, the podcaster Tim Ferriss. It's a favourite question of his, and I really, really liked it. And part of the reason why I like that question is that it takes us away from too much perfectionism. We move away from perfectionism about the outcome and start focusing instead on the ease of the process. And when we focus on the ease of the process, what we get to instead, ironically enough, is often a better outcome. So in this episode, I'm going to talk about how that impacts why I do psychotherapy and the way that I do it, but also as well, how it actually can impact your life too. You know, I remember a project that something I was building quite a few years ago, and it was one of those where I was up against a time deadline, and I was trying to make it perfect. I was trying to make it all shiny and all singing and all dancing. The kind of like fussing that we do around the edges of things. And I paused and stopped and asked myself the question, what would this look like if it was easy? And as a result, I had to drop pretty much all of my ideas as to how I wanted this to work and go with the clunky option, the one that didn't look quite so great. And yet it got the job done exactly the same as the slick option that was going to take me ages and ensure that I missed my deadline. And so I did it that way and it was fine. And in the same way, you know, this podcast itself is a testament to asking that question, what would this look like if it was easy? You see, I've done podcasts before, but podcasts tend to fall over in time. We stop doing them. It's a very common thing because what happens with podcasts is there's this part, the enjoyable part of sharing ideas and having a chat to you. But then behind the scenes, you then have to export the sound file from the software that you're talking into. You have to then upload that sound file to the internet, to a podcast server host. You then have to tell the podcast server host what's on the sound file so people can actually understand what they're going to get, you know, the title and the description. And then you have to set something up so there's a blog post on your site, and then you have to send an email to people and write that out and send it. And instead, I found this app, which I'm using now, where you're just talking to your phone and I press a button and everything is basically done. I've done a few other automated tweaks so that I automatically get a blog post, so that I automatically get it syndicated to iTunes and Google and all of these places. It automatically sends out an email to let you know that there's a new podcast. And so by asking the question, what would this look like if it was easy? What's actually happened is that, okay, I could have done it that other way. You know, I've got recording equipment and it could have sounded much more professional, you know, almost like a BBC recording. But the likelihood is I wouldn't have got to over 300 episodes because every time I needed to do a podcast, I'd think about all that ugly stuff at the end and I wouldn't have done it. And so instead, I asked myself the question, what would this look like if it was easy? And that's how I come to find this particular app. So it's a question that is worth asking yourself, not just once, but repeatedly. Whenever you're about to do something, what would this look like if it was easy? And in fact, what would this look like if it was fun? And so what happens is, weirdly enough, because you take your focus away from the outcome and focus instead on the ease of the process, then you actually get a much nicer process. And weirdly, you actually end up with a better outcome. You know, 300 odd episodes, even if slightly imperfect in terms of the sound quality, is much, much, much better outcome than, say, 5 episodes that are done perfectly. Now, this question of what would this look like if it was easy, that often nags away at me and gets me to better results, is something that strongly informed my journey as a psychotherapist as well, because I really value that thing called ease. I really like things that are easy. And what I noticed in terms of the psychotherapy field that I was part of was that it wasn't easy for people, that actually there was an awful lot of stuff that was really, really hard. And so advice was coming out of the therapy communities and the self-help communities that in actual fact, to enact that advice wasn't just hard, but it often felt almost impossible. One of the things I used to do was do workshops for something called nonviolent communication. And nonviolent communication is still something I really like. It is really useful. But there are certain times where, no matter how useful it is, it's not easy to access. So what nonviolent communication is a way of having difficult conversations in a way that is very, very connecting. And if anybody wanted to hear more about that, I'll happily do a podcast on it because it is useful. It's just that in certain states, when we have those difficult conversations, we're in emotional states where our biology means that it's very, very difficult to access it. So in nonviolent communication, you speak from the I. So the letter I, which means me, you know, you speak about yourself. You'll point out a particular situation that's occurred in a completely non-judgmental, as if you're looking at a TV camera recording or something. You'll point out the situation. You'll say, when that happened, I felt this emotion because I have this need. And so the whole basis on it is that you're talking about yourself rather than pointing a finger out at the other person. And you're simply sharing. And in that sharing, inviting the other person to empathize with your emotional feeling, while at the same time inviting them to have the gift of being able to make a contribution to meeting that need. And so if we don't use very blamey language, then the other person is naturally, if they can, we enjoy meeting each other's need. And yet certain ways we communicate can get in the way of that. So I used to teach workshops on this so that when you're having a difficult conversation, that you can say, well, when this happened, or when this happens, if it's a recurring thing, you know, I feel really sad and disheartened because I have a need for connection with you, for instance. And you can see that's a very neutral way of having that difficult conversation and having it in a connecting way because you're inviting the other person to connect. Now, I still think that's really valuable, but here's my noticing around ease. When you're triggered, like in a fight or flight state, and so your nervous system is responding as if you're in a place of existential threat, then as simple as that is, it's not easy anymore to even access it. And then maybe 2 hours later, you look back at the flare up and think, oh yeah, if only I'd just said, you know, when this happens, I feel that because I have a need for this, then everything would have been fine. But it's really hard to access it when we're in this heightened nervous system state. And so what's happening there is we'll have these logical resources, But as you know, with the nervous system, because we've all got one, we've all experienced that spike of fight or flight. When you're in that state of fight or flight, one of the things that naturally happens is that our thinking mechanisms are actually really reduced. We don't really need to think too much when a lion or a saber-toothed tiger steps into the room. We just need to put all of our attention on getting out the way, on running away, of escaping that predator. And so by the same token, when our nervous system reacts as if we're in a life threat, it's no longer easy to take this advice that you'll often find in books about having better relationships and having better communication styles, because it's really hard to access any of that advice when you're in a place of real autonomic nervous system spike, where you feel as though you have to fight or flee because your nervous system is telling you that you're in a state of life threat. So all of this advice that we see in self-help books, an awful lot of it has a fatal flaw. And the fatal flaw is that it overlooks the fact that we're human beings who have nervous systems, and that those nervous systems are very sensitive to any cue that we are in danger, that we're under the kind of threat that maybe we were in once during our childhood, for instance. It overlooks the fact that those nervous systems have learned experiences and learned histories. And it also overlooks the fact as well that the nervous system, when you're in that place, puts itself in control, in the protection of you. It's kind of lovely in a sense that we've all got this independent, involuntary, protective force around us all the time. But that involuntary protective force, even if it's mistaken in thinking that you're under threat, that you're in danger, even if it's got that wrong, will actually take over and kind of do a complete body hijack. So if you think of a smoke alarm, one of those smoke alarms where they're connected to the local fire station. And so if your smoke alarm goes off, then it'll ring a bell in the local fire station and the fire brigade will come down, they'll whack your door down, and then they'll fill your house with water. Well, that's actually what it's like for us as well. So we've got a smoke alarm, and it's that part of our brain that spots threat. And when it spots threat, it sends the fire brigade round. And what it does is it floods you with adrenaline and all sorts of other chemicals. It speeds up your heart rate so it can send blood to your muscles so you can effectively do the whole fight or flight thing. And so our nervous systems take over in that way. Even if there's not actually a fire, even if it's only something that reminds it of the fire, even if, say, you're boiling the kettle and it's just steam. And so this is basically how we operate. So the fatal flaw in all of this advice that makes taking the advice really difficult is that the moment that we need to take the advice, we're already in that state of fight or flight. And so the question for me is, how do we make that easier for people rather than impossible? So that led me to start studying the nervous system itself, because this is the thing that takes power in those moments. These are the things that say, you're under threat, and so I'm going to do all kind of things to your body to make this situation uncomfortable enough that you withdraw. And this is what happens whenever we do anything, I suppose, and move towards something, change included. Your nervous system will kick in. You'll notice this yourself. Any change that feels hard, as you move towards that change, there'll be some sort of uncomfortable response in the body, and that's your nervous system kind of playing up. And so that led me then to a study of the nervous system, and in particular, something that is called polyvagal theory. It was developed by a guy called Dr. Stephen Porges, who actually has nothing to do with psychotherapy. He's a medical researcher. And what he noticed was that the nervous system actually has three different states, and that the nervous system, he recognized, which is what I liked, he recognized this insight that I was having, which is that the nervous system actually hijacks us. It takes control. And so what he said is we've got three states. We've got our default state, which would be calm, not for everyone, of course, but the default state would be calm. For some of us, the default state will be one of the other two because our nervous system has learned that that's the safest state to be in. But the default that we'd want to get to is a state of calm. And then when we're in fight or flight, that's another nervous system response to not being safe. And then another response to not feeling safe is that we'll go into that kind of slow, numb, withdrawn, shutdown. And so there's a lot of people writing about polyvagal theory. But the thing that I noticed, which again, seems like a fatal flaw around this question of what would this look like if it was easy, is that what people teach is that you need to befriend your nervous system. And what they mean by this is that you still get to keep the smoke alarm that's oversensitive, but through all of these kind of exercises that you have to do day in, day out, what you will learn is how to turn the smoke alarm off again. So the smoke alarm's going to go off even when you're boiling the kettle. Nothing you can do about that, they say. And of course, the fire brigade are going to come and smash your door down and flood your house with water. But you're going to know how to turn that smoke alarm off. And that's what they mean by befriending the nervous system. But as you can hear again, it's not easy. It depends on lots of learning. It depends on doing exercises. There is even somebody in this kind of space who focuses on the nervous system that teaches all these various exercises. And what they say is, this is like going to the gym and you have to do this every day. Well, again, to me, what would this look like if it was easy? It doesn't look like that. We all have lives. Lives are complicated enough, even when we haven't got trauma to deal with. We've got kids to take to school. We've got work to go to. We've got all sorts of things. We've got the shopping, the laundry. There's plenty of things that we have to do all the time. We don't really need to add another one on, do we? Just because we were people who happened to have suffered trauma. That seems like not easy at all. That seems to be making life harder. So again, a fatal flaw. What would this look like if it was easy? Well, the way I saw it, not that. You see, what I don't like about that is it's teaching us how to simply manage trauma. It's basically saying, look, this is what your nervous system does. And it does that because it's a trauma response. And we're going to leave you with that, but we're going to give you all these exercises that you have to do every day. And if you don't do them every day, then that's a personal failure on your part. I don't like that at all. That goes against that core question around ease of what would this look like if it was easy? Because when you're managing trauma response, we can win a little bit, but ultimately the trauma response, if it sticks around, if it's allowed to stick around, as these approaches allow it to stick around, if it's just a management technique of this thing that we're going to keep, then we might have little victories. We might even have short-term victories. But what you've got to remember is this trauma response came about at a time where it really felt threatening for us. The trauma response comes about where it really did feel on some level, and it might not be an obvious thing like somebody coming in and threatening to kill us, but on some level, it felt kind of existential. It felt like we were in danger and we needed to try and navigate a way through. And so this trauma response comes from such a time. And so it's seeing cues in the present, which make it think that we're still in such a time. So this is a trauma response. This is a nervous system response that is desperately trying to keep you alive. It's actually our very life force. That's what's happening here. Now, if ever you've seen the film 10 Meter Tower, if you haven't, Google it, 10 Meter Tower, you'll see people 35 foot high on a diving board, and they've walked all the way up to jump off the diving board. But when they get to the edge and they see just how far up they are, well, their nervous system, their life force kicks in instead and starts to drag them. You'll see it physically, starts to drag them backwards to the back of the diving board, further and further away from the edge. Now, that life force is powerful, thank goodness, because it's there to protect us. Even if it's making some of its decisions now on outdated predictions, it's there to protect us. And so when we go with an approach which basically says, look, we're going to keep the trauma response, we're going to keep that life force as powerful, we're just going to wrestle with it, we're just going to try and manage it and tame it in some way, then you might get a small victory. But it's a bit like this. Try just holding your breath. Now, if you hold your breath, your body wants to breathe. Your life force wants to breathe. So you can hold your breath, and maybe 10, 15, 20 seconds in, you'll be thinking, I'm doing really well here. I'm doing great. I can hold my breath. This is no problem. 30 seconds in might even be the same. But 2 minutes in, you're not going to be able to hold it because the life force wants to breathe. Now, this, I think, is the big problem with a lot of the ways that people are taught how to respond to trauma. Because trauma responses kick off that nervous system response, which is that life force. And we can manage it to an extent, but ultimately, the life force is far more powerful. And it's really like asking people to hold their breath, praising them during the first 30 seconds, but then 3 minutes in, when they suddenly have to start breathing again, tutting and shaking your heads at people because they failed, in inverted commas, to manage the trauma. Now, when I use that question, what does it look like if it was easy? Well, it's certainly not easy to try and tame that life force. It's certainly not easy to try and hold your breath forever and a day. It's not easy to manage a trauma response. So there is a better way. And that question, what will it look like if it was easy, meant that I was really dissatisfied with the approach that I've just described. Even though it does bring some improvements, it really does. And it's not useful. You know, it's not useless. There are some uses to it. But ultimately, for me, it wasn't easy. And so it meant that I sought something that went a level deeper again. So what does this change look like if it was easy? Well, the way I see it is the easiest way is if the trauma was never there in the first place. Because people who didn't have that trauma don't have to do all these kind of exercises every day, don't have to manage this particular trauma response. They're not having to wrestle with this all the time to learn exercises and skills and go on courses and do routines. So the easiest thing is if the trauma was never there in the first place. But that ship has sailed, obviously, because we can't change history. So the other alternative is, okay, so the trauma response is there. What would this look like if it was easy? Well, if it was easy, the trauma response would be erased again. It would be gotten rid of so that we remember the event, but it no longer gives us that traumatic reaction to the event. It doesn't trigger that life force of the nervous system responding to an outdated prediction. But we keep that life force for when we actually need it, when the situation actually is dangerous, not just looks dangerous, resembles back then, but actually is safe in this moment. So what does it look like if it was easy? It would look like the trauma being completely and utterly removed. And of course, this is why I was so excited when I learned about the neuroscientific breakthrough that is known as memory reconsolidation. Now, what memory reconsolidation is a brain mechanism. It's simply how your brain works. It's just that until just under a quarter of a century ago, neuroscientists didn't know that that's the way the brain worked. They thought that once you had the trauma that you did have to keep hold of it. But what they found, and they've replicated it over 30 times since, is that the way the brain actually works is it has a learning mechanism that can update a trauma response with the new reality. It can take what was written back then that helped you navigate the trauma back then, but is now getting in the way of your life because it's that smoke alarm that keeps going off just because you're boiling the kettle, and re-educate it so it knows that that's just the kettle and it's perfectly safe. So what memory reconsolidation does is it simply is a way of doing psychotherapy that allows that natural updating learning mechanism of your brain to trigger. And it's something which basically is done through talking, and it's done through imaginal exercises. And the result of that is that the trauma is actually removed. And so you can see as you follow that journey along from me doing those nonviolent communication workshops of just follow this sentence structure, tell the other person what you feel and what you need and make a request of them, that can't actually be done in a heightened nervous system response. And then going deeper to learn about the nervous system and being dissatisfied with that as well, to coming up with this thing of, this isn't just about how to turn off a smoke alarm that goes off every time you boil a kettle. This is about re-educating the smoke alarm. So now it works as it's meant to do, in that it only actually alarms if there's actual real smoke. And so what memory reconsolidation can do, it can take your trauma response and completely overwrite it. And so when something in the now resembles back then, when that cue is still there in the environment, you actually have a very neutral response to it. That your response is, I know that thing happened and I know it was a bad thing, but in the here and now, I don't have any response to it. I don't have any distress to it. And that, in terms of psychotherapy, is the real answer to the question of what would this look like if it was easy? Because what it would look like is you having no trauma response anymore at all. If you found this episode useful, please do share it so others can get the benefit as well. And if you'd like to work with me directly, I'm Alan Parry, and you can find out more about how I work at liverpoolpsychotherapy.co.uk. And of course, you don't have to be local to me because I work 100% online, so you can be based absolutely anywhere. Also, I want to let you know about a free video course that I've put together for you, and it's called Childhood Trauma Gone for Good. And it shows you how your trauma can now be completely eliminated. You can get that video series completely free. Just go to aSliceOfTherapy.com/free. And please subscribe to the podcast as well, because this is free too. And it means that you'll never miss an episode again. So thanks for listening, and I'll see you again on the next one.